with Scott Allen.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in this beautiful world. I am your host, Scott J. Allen, and this is Phronesis, Practical Wisdom for Leaders. Now, I am a professor of management at John Carroll University in Cleveland, Ohio, USA. In addition, I'm a husband and father of three teens. Now, this is a family endeavor. Will played the intro, Kate voiced the intro, and who knows, you may hear from Emily a little later. I'm also an author, entrepreneur, speaker, and co-founder of the Collegiate Leadership Competition. I love to travel, explore new places with family, and learn from others. Phronesis offers a smart, fast-paced discussion about all things leadership and followership, if we're honest. My guests are scholars and practitioners, and we cover relevant topics and incorporate practical tips designed to help you make a difference in how you lead and live. I am proud to share a few updates. According to Listen Notes, Phronesis is listed as among the top 3% of podcasts in the world because of you. So thank you. In addition, the podcast has two sponsors. First, Phronesis is the official podcast of the International Leadership Association, an association that is near and dear to my heart. ILA brings together leaders and those who teach, study, and develop leadership, advancing leadership knowledge and practice for a better world. Learn more at ila-net.org. My second sponsor is the Bowler College of Business at John Carroll University. At Bowler, we offer several advanced degrees and MBAs, and I'm confident that there's one that will fit your location, interests, and timeline. In fact, our online MBA is ranked as the number one in Ohio and number nine in the United States. We offer international study tours, a contemporary and forward-looking curriculum, and access to senior leaders and flagship organizations. Learn more at business.jcu.edu. You can find links to both sponsors in the show notes. Now, if you like what we're up to, please hit subscribe so you can stay current as we release new episodes each week. You can also share what we're up to with others, friends, colleagues, leaders, teams, students, and others you think will benefit. And now, today's show. Okay, everybody, welcome to the Phronesis podcast. Thank you so much for checking in wherever you are in the world. Today, my guest is Dr. Randall Pinkett, and he established himself as an entrepreneur, speaker, author, and scholar, and as a leading voice for his generation in business and technology. He is the founder, chairman, and CEO of his fifth venture, BCT Partners, a multi-million dollar research, consulting, training, technology, and analytics firm headquartered in Newark, New Jersey. Dr. Pinkett has received numerous awards for business and technology excellence, including the Information Technology Senior Management Forum's Beacon Award, the National Society of Black Engineers Entrepreneur of the Year Award, and the National Urban League's Business Excellence Award. He has been featured on nationally televised programs such as The Today Show, Fox Business News, MSNBC, CNN. And in 2009, he was named to New Jersey Governor John Corzine's official shortlist as a potential running mate for Lieutenant Governor of New Jersey. Dr. Pinkett is the author of Campus CEO, the Student Entrepreneur's Guide to Launching a Multi-Million Dollar Business, and No Money Down CEO, How to Start Your Dream Business with Little or No Cash. And he's the co-author of Black Faces in White Places, 10 Game-Changing Strategies to Achieve Success and Find Greatness, which was named one of the best books of 2010. He holds 5 degrees, including a BS in electrical engineering from Rutgers, an MS in computer science from the University of Oxford in England, an MS in electrical engineering, an MBA, and a PhD from MIT. Most notably, he was the first and only African-American to receive the prestigious Rhodes Scholarship at Rutgers University. He was inducted to the Academic All-America Hall of Fame. He was a former high jumper, long jumper, sprinter, and captain of the men's track and field team. And he was the winner of NBC's hit reality television show, The Apprentice. Born in Philadelphia and raised in New Jersey, Dr. Pinkett is a proud member of Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity and the First Baptist Church in Somerset, New Jersey, where he resides with his family, including a daughter and 2 sons. Dr. Pinkett firmly believes that for those to whom much is given, much is expected. So throughout his endeavors, he places great emphasis on his desire to give back to the community. Sir, thank you for being with us today. What else do listeners need to know about you? What's not in that incredibly impressive resume? My gosh, you are a busy man.
Well, first, Scott, it's great to be in the program. I will just add 3 things. First, I don't get much sleep. second and third, I've released books 4 and 5. So book 4 is Black Faces in High Places. That's the sequel to the book you referenced, Black Faces in White Places.
Great.
And then just recently I released book 5, Data-Driven DEI, the tools and metrics you need to measure, analyze, and improve diversity, equity, and inclusion. So points 2 and 3 are a reminder of point 1, that I don't get my sleep.
Well, you know, I am excited for our conversation about this latest book. And it was in some of the materials that were sent to me ahead of time that there's this quote that I just really kind of, it stood out for me and I really enjoy it. And it is, the ultimate objective is to make DEI a part of your DNA. Your overarching aim is that the 5-step never-ending continuous cycle of data-driven DEI becomes a natural part of who you are and what you do. There's a couple things in there that I really, really resonate with. And this part of never-ending continuous cycle, data-driven, I'm excited to jump in and really, really have a conversation about elements of your model today. But would you talk a little bit about the impetus of the book?
Yeah. After George Floyd's murder, there was a watershed of interest and dialogue and in some ways concern about matters relating to diversity, equity, and inclusion. I released a video called The 7 Myths of Racial Equity shortly after or in the wake of his tragic murder. And I was approached by a acquisitions editor at Wiley about converting that video into a book. And as we got into deeper and deeper conversations, and he learned more about my background, and I learned more about their interest, he said, I think there's a better book for you to consider, given your background in technology and data and computer science, given your expertise in diversity, equity, and inclusion. What do you think about data-driven DEI? And I said, ooh, I like that. I said, I like it. And we began this redirection from 7 Myths of Racial Equity to data-driven DEI. And I came to realize that this moniker in many ways encapsulates the totality of the work we've done at my firm, BCT Partners, which is a data-driven approach to DEI. But the last thing I'll say, which was a gift to me from the publisher, and it gets back to your question, was the perception of a book like this is probably it's for DEI leaders and champions and executives. And actually, it is for those audiences, but they're not the primary audience. The primary audience is anyone who desires more diverse relationships, more inclusive behaviors, and more equitable practices. Because at the end of the day, this is a personal journey. And that's why this excerpt about DEI being in your DNA is at the core of the impetus for the book.
You start there, right? You start in that space of, okay, have you done your own personal work? And have you done your own investigation of this topic, right? If I'm correct, it's step 0, right?
That's right. Yeah, the book is based on a 5-step methodology, but there's a step 0.
Yeah.
Ground zero. Each step begins with the letter I. And that first step is looking at your DI incentives, your incentives. And that is a matter of self-reflection and introspection to ask the deeper probing questions of why does this matter to you in the first place? And that could be intrinsically, it's a reflection of my values or my religion or my upbringing or how I believe I should live my life, or it could be extrinsic. It's in my performance evaluation. So I didn't really care before, but I want my bonus. And so I care now. So it could be intrinsic, extrinsic, or both. But I ask readers to ask those deeper probing questions to clarify what motivates you to care about this topic in the first place.
Would you talk a little bit more about that? Because I think the next step we move into is inventory, where we do some assessment. But what are the types of questions people have to explore in this step 0, the incentives, the self-reflect and introspect space?
So I challenge the readers to craft a DEI mission and vision. Now, most people don't have a personal mission and vision, and that's separate from DEI. I'm a big fan of Stephen Covey's Seven Habits of Highly Effective People.
Like, oh yeah.
I've read that book in college and it still is in my system. And Covey talks about writing a personal mission and vision. Mission answering the question, why do you exist? What's your purpose? What's your calling? And vision answering the question, what future picture do you hope to create? Like, how is the world a better place because of your presence in the world? So I whiffed off of that and said, well, what about a DEI mission and vision? And in fact, with our clients, all of our clients have an organizational mission and vision. Those are the foundations of any organization. But we then walk them through a process of crafting a DEI mission and vision. And I translate that to the reader to say, do a personal DEI mission and a personal DEI vision. Because that clarification of what do you see as your why? What is the calling or the mission or the purpose that you see yourself from a diversity, equity, and inclusion perspective? And then even more interestingly, how do you see the world being a better place relative to diversity, equity, and inclusion because of whatever efforts you may undertake from the book? So those are the two core fundamental questions. Answer the question, what's your DEI mission and what's your DEI vision?
Well, I like that because it situates the learner in how this topic is relevant to them, why it matters. To your point, going back to that why, and it sets and lays that foundation in a really, really nice way so that it's personal, right? That this is me and this is my objective. These are my goals and this is what I see an ideal future being. We might not be there now, but this is why it's important, right?
That's exactly right. And in the absence of taking the time to answer those questions, because again, like you said, the next step is doing an assessment. But for this to have any sustainability, for this to have any real impact, it has to matter to you. Like anything else in life, it has to matter to you. And most people don't write down their goals, much less write down their mission or vision. And so I have found, because in the book, I share my personal DEI mission and vision. The exercise for me was extraordinarily valuable.
Would you share yours real quick, just so listeners have a sense of how you think about it?
So my personal DEI mission is to deeply understand the experiences of people who are different than me, to personalize individuals and mitigate the impact of my biases, to be an ally in equal partnership with those less privileged than me, and to treat people the way they want to be treated. The gold standard is treat people the way you want to be treated. The platinum standard is treat them the way they want to be treated. And so my vision is the following. I will have authentic, culturally diverse, and global relationships. I will bridge differences and be a bridge between communities of the like-minded. I will behave inclusively toward others and be an inclusive servant leader. And I will dismantle personal, interpersonal, institutional, and systemic barriers to help create environments that produce equitable outcomes for all. That's my DEI mission and vision.
You know, just hearing yours, it's a powerful experience just listening to what you've crafted, because it very clearly and nicely situates you in the work, right? I mean, it's powerful.
I appreciate that. You know, even reading it, there was a part that particularly moved me, and it's my vision.
Yeah, that's the part of how wrote that.
Exactly. I will bridge differences and be a bridge between communities of the like-minded. And I believe part of the challenge in our society is that we all, including me, let's be honest, increasingly find ourselves in communities of the like-minded. That we're surrounded by people who look like us, think like us, share our values, our political ideology. We're watching the same news programs and we're in the same echo chamber on social media, which means you're not getting different points of view. And sometimes you don't even realize it. And it creates these communities of the like-minded that make us more prone to casting stereotypes on those who are not in our community of the like-minded. It's when we say they don't understand it or they got it wrong. That's when you know you're caught in a community of the like-minded. And what we need are people who can be bridges between them. Otherwise, the fabric of our society and democracy will remain frayed.
So well said.
And to your point, you know, we have these digital echo chambers, but then you have these echo chambers of physical space at times too, right? With the demographics of the U.S., you look at the maps and there's a lot of red and then there's dots of blue, and less people are interacting with people with those differences, whether it be however we want to define difference. And I think that's detrimental, absolutely detrimental.
I agree. And if you think about it, Scott, there are only two places or spaces in life where you have no choice but to interact with people that may be different than you: school and work. Mm. That's it. Everywhere else, you have complete choice where to worship, where to seek entertainment, where to go to dinner, but only in school and work will you have to sit in a cubicle or a desk next to somebody that you're just told to sit next to that person, which means if you're out of school like me, there's only one place left where you have no choice but to interact with difference, and that's work. So if we're not intentional and vigilant about placing ourselves into situations where we're engaging with people different than us, the likelihood, to your point, geographically, is going down every day.
Well, let's transition into a couple of the aspects of the model. You know, my area of passion traditionally in research and scholarship has been in leader development. And leader development has notoriously been difficult to quantify. The individual program that we have implemented has, you know, you're a leader, right? It's difficult. It's a challenge because it's a fun puzzle. It's an interesting puzzle. So I love how you're thinking about, okay, how do we, and again, this continuous cycle, we are all at the individual level in this continuous cycle of growth and learning, but then we as an organization are in this continuous cycle as well. And how do we ensure that our initiatives, our efforts are yielding the results we want, that we're moving the needle, because this is a type of topic where we're shifting, we're moving the needle. We aren't necessarily quote unquote done, right? This, I don't know that this work is ever complete. So let's talk a little bit about assessments. We're getting a baseline here, I'm assuming.
That's exactly right. And I'll riff off your narrative with the question. It is a never ending journey. There is no destination. There is only successive and iterative improvements. There's always more we can learn. There's always more we can grow. It's the growth mindset that we're channeling in many ways. And assessment is such a critical piece, because if you don't know where you are, you don't know where you're going. And it is an assessment that gives you insight to where you have strengths, where you have limitations, where you have preferences, where you have competences. And in fact, I talk about two ways of assessing through a DEI lens: your preferences, your natural inclinations, some would call those your biases. And the reason why we want to assess your preferences is because if you have a preference for people who are like you, you may have a blind spot when it comes to dealing with people who are not like you. If you have a preference for naturally engaging with women, you may have a blind spot when you're interviewing men. And so that's preferences. The other is competences. What are you, you know, and that's knowledge, skills, and attitudes, KSAs, knowledge, skills, and attitudes. You want to assess your competences, because the goal for a preference is to mitigate your bias, mitigate your blind spot. The goal for a competence is to build the competence. And so are you looking to become to behave more inclusively? That's a competence. Are you looking to bridge and navigate differences? That's a competence. Are you looking to be a better leader, which you referenced a moment ago, Scott? That's a competence. And we can break down the subcomponents. We can assess you. And now you know where you are, which can then focus you on enhancing your strengths. And more importantly, also addressing areas that may be areas of limitation or areas of preference that you can now grow as a person.
Yeah. So we have this profile and baseline that we have. Now, move us into this step two, which is imperatives, where in this space, we're kind of determining priorities, DEI objectives and goals. And now I imagine you're thinking of this at the organizational level, but maybe it's in the team level, maybe it's at an individual level. Do you see this as something that is multi-level, so to speak? I mean, I conceptually, for sure. Have you written about it in that way?
Yes. This book follows two tracks, a personal track and an organizational track. The personal track walks the person through their own journey of data-driven DEI, and the organizational tract is the same for a company, a nonprofit, a foundation, government agency, et cetera. And again, each step begins with the letter I. We've walked through DEI incentives, then DEI inventory, and now we're at DEI imperatives. What are the things that matter that you want to accomplish? And I use a model, OGSM, objectives, goals, strategies, and measures. So for this step, it's just the OG, and that's not to be colloquial. It's just the OG, the objectives and the goals. Objectives are a qualitative articulation of what you want to accomplish. I want to be a more inclusive leader. Just plain talk. What do you want to do? The goal is, how are you going to measure yourself against that objective?
Yep.
So if it is, I want to be a more inclusive leader, then I might take as my inventory the intrinsic inclusion inventory, the I3. The intrinsic inclusion inventory measures me on inclusive behaviors and will baseline me from my prior step. Now, if my goal is more inclusive behaviors as a leader, now I'm going to say I'm going to increase my intrinsic inclusion inventory score by 10%. Okay. Or I'm going to go from level 3 to level 4. We'll come back later to what am I going to do to accomplish that. But if I quantify the objective with a goal, I know what my target is. And that's a data-driven approach.
Nice. Say more about this space. Say more about kind of this element where we are really focusing on, you know, outlining those imperatives.
This OGSM model, I love it because it brings the best of both worlds of qualitative and quantitative. The objective is the plain talk for those who appreciate words. The goal is for those who appreciate numbers, who want to measure and make certain they know where they're going. So from an organizational perspective, it could be we want to create a more inclusive culture where people want to experience the culture and the climate positively. The predecessor of that was employee engagement surveys, where people wanted employees to feel engaged. Well, now the gold standard is not employee engagement, it's inclusion and belonging. Hmm. People feeling like they are included and they belong. And I can measure inclusion. At BCT, we have our own instrument called the DEI Workforce and Workplace Assessment. Lots of other firms and organizations have. And the book lays out no less than 25, if not 30 different instruments that you can find. Some are freely available that can measure your culture and climate. 30, 40, 50 questions you ask your employees. Do I feel like I belong? Do I feel like I'm honored? Do I feel like my voice is heard? And I can then do interviews and focus groups to hear from people firsthand, because qualitative data is also data. People often assume surveys are the only form of data. I can do an interview or a focus group, gather that information. I can analyze it. And now I can again establish an objective, a more inclusive culture, and a goal. If I have an inclusive culture survey, I can produce an index. Say my index is 0 to 100 and I score out at 55. I want to move from a 55 to a 75 in the next year, which means I've improved on my inclusive culture. That's again, a way of establishing an objective and a goal. That's the OG.
Yep. Well, and I love how you're framing the quantitative and the qualitative, because I think that mixed methodology, right, will help us see a more holistic picture versus what one or the other would potentially produce. And so I love how you're thinking about that. So we move on to 3, which is insights. Identify what works. I'm excited to hear about this. What works?
Yeah. Step 3 is one of my favorite steps. And again, I'm biased because I wrote the book.
But it's really awesome. Yeah.
Well, it was one of my favorite steps. And I learned this from my colleague, Pete York. He's our chief data scientist at BCT. Dude is brilliant. And DEI Insight says, before you decide what you're going to do to accomplish your objective, like what strategies will you pursue, rather than jumping right to, I'm going to go to a course, or I'm going to read a book, or I'm going to watch a video, pause for a moment and ask the question, what's worked for somebody else? Hmm. What's worked for another organization? What's considered a promising or proven practice that I'm not reinventing the wheel? Almost think about it like aiming at a target. If you've got your bow and arrow and someone can tell you, well, if you hold it like this, you're more likely to hit the target. Or if you point it in this direction, you're more likely to hit the target. Would you accept that advice? Of course you would. So step 3 is saying, don't just pull back the bow and release the arrow. Ask someone to tell you what worked for them or what worked in another context. And if you go to datadrivendei.com, I have already done some of that work for you. Mm. I have what works models for people and what works models for organizations on the site. I'm talking mobile apps that will nudge you on inclusive behaviors. That's the inclusion habit. Virtual reality immersions, that's through my eyes, that can give you an experience that's immersive, unlike anything you've seen before. Equitable analytics for organizations that can analyze your data and tell you what works for whom at a very granular level. All of these models are there, and I've invited people to send me new models to add to the website. So it's helping you to scaffold your journey and not reinvent the wheel. DEI insights, what works.
So it's almost in some ways benchmarking and scanning the landscape to figure out, okay, what is available? What are the opportunities? I love you just mentioned some technology here. So there are apps that will actually help me work towards some of these goals.
Yeah. Check out the inclusionhabit.com. Dr. Amanda Felke came up with what is the equivalent of Noom for inclusive behaviors. For those who don't know Noom, Noom is a mobile app that will coach you on nutrition and wellness, and it's best based on a model for different food groups. Well, imagine a model for inclusive behavior, and this thing will give you what's called micro commitments, things you commit to do on a daily basis that research has proven will lead you to behaving more inclusively. That's one example of a what works model that you'd want to know before you undertake your journey.
Well, and there's some really cool, whether it's James Clear and the Atomic Habits. I don't know if you've had a chance to explore Atomic Habits or BJ Fogg. I'm going to write a book called Little Baby Tiny Habits. My version of 7-minute abs, right?
I love it.
But I like that phrasing, micro commitments. I think that's wonderful phrasing. Okay, so we can even access some technology. We've got some best practices. We have some resources that we can tap into as to how we can move forward. And then we've got this initiative, step four.
Yeah, step four takes the OG and goes over to the SM. So remember, DEI imperatives was objectives and goals. Then there's the SM, strategies and measures. Yep. So DEI initiatives, which is step four, DEI initiatives. So, okay, now what are we going to do? We've clarified our vision with DEI incentives. We've established our baseline with DEI inventory. We've laid out broad objectives and goals with DEI imperatives, and we know what works for others with DEI insights. Now you got to figure out what you're going to do. Yep. And I think it's noteworthy that this model doesn't get to what to do until step four. There's a lot of groundwork to make certain that when you decide what you're going to do, that you're directed in the right direction. So DEI initiative says, what are the strategies that you're going to employ? What books, what articles, what courses, what experiences? And I'm talking broadly. It could be movies. It could be travel. It could be dialogue. It could be a lunch. It could be, and then for an organization, it could be employee resource groups. It could be courageous conversations. It could be organization-wide training, learning, and development. There's lots of strategies one could pursue. But step three helped to inform what they should be that might work for you. And then the measures helps us to put a quantification on the strategy. So if I'm going to read a book, how many? I'm going to attend a course. What do I expect to be my score on the test at the end of the course? If I'm going to establish ERGs, what's my target for the number of people I want involved? Whereas objectives and goals are about outcomes. What do I ultimately want to accomplish? Mm. Strategies and measures are about outputs. An output is I attended the training. An output is I read the book. An output is I watched the video. An output is I have people in the ERG. But an output is not an outcome, because the ultimate goal was a more inclusive culture. The ultimate goal was behave more inclusively. And so our objective is about outcomes. Our strategies are about outputs, which are considered intermediate steps to get to the final outcomes that I desire.
I'm not reacting to what you just said, but I have like seven things going through my mind. And I just have great appreciation for the fact that you're working at multiple levels, individual and organizational. I have appreciation for the fact that as we're thinking about how to quantify some of this, it's qualitative, it's quantitative. I love that you've defined outcomes and outputs. I mean, it's just nicely packaged so that an individual can, it's clear. There's a very clear process and a path forward, because as you know, this topic is complex. It is not an easy topic. And there's people's minds are in multiple spaces, and there's a lot of different ways that we can approach it. But I have a great appreciation for how you're thinking about this and how you're approaching it. And, you know, I think what I would love to, as we begin to kind of wind down on our time, what I would love to hear from you is, what do you see that's kind of promising right now? We used that word hope earlier. What do you see that's promising in the work that you're doing? And as you're doing that work, what's kind of coming up on your radar as, oof, we need to figure this one out, or these few out, we're not gaining the traction we would hope to gain in a couple of these areas. So based on what you're seeing, what's giving you hope? What is positive in the work right now?
What's giving me hope is that I still see momentum from the groundswell of attention that we saw in 2020. While there are some organizations that pursued DEI because it was performative or it was reactionary, and they made commitments that they perhaps have not lived up to, I do see organizations that talk the talk and are now walking the walk and are making progress and are leaning in and maintaining and making progress against the commitments that they made. And that is encouraging. I think the rap has been that all these commitments were empty. And this has not been my experience, that they were empty commitments. There were some that were, but there were many that are and continue to be sustained. Good. The part that concerns me, and it's funny how we started out talking about DEI and DNA, because as I see the growing proliferation of artificial intelligence and the likes of a ChatGPT and these large language models and what this will mean for the DEI space, we have to remind ourselves and in some ways remain vigilant that we keep our DNA in the DEI, meaning that our humanity remains first and foremost in a space that I've helped to contribute to making more data-driven and more AI-driven and more machine learning-driven and more ChatGPT-driven. We have to keep our DNA in that space of DEI, which means we have to have transparency on these algorithms to know what's happening under the hood. We have to be more interrogating to make sure that the data that they're trained on itself is representative and is itself diverse, that when it's offering up recommendations and producing insights, that they're not narrowly defined or narrowly construed because the data set itself was narrowly constructed. So we have to make sure humanity leads the way and that the machines follow us. We don't follow the machines.
If we were just to go to the media, so to speak, I mean, we've seen what algorithms can produce, right? I mean, it's they're producing what's getting people riled up, and that's what's getting clicked on, and that's what's, and then, you know, the impacts of an algorithm for listeners, that's a very simple, easy example of the impact of an algorithm. It elevates what's being clicked on to mm-hmm. sell revenue and ads. Right. That keeps us agitated.
That's right.
On edge, so to speak, at times. But I love what you're saying, because I think if we are going to create that inclusivity, and if we are going to keep that as a goal, how is that? And again, that's on any number of different dimensions, right, Randall? I mean, it's gender, right? Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. And if what X percentage of these individuals coding are male? Just mm-hmm. even unconsciously, the biases that are being floated into the algorithms, there's concern, right?
And that's so, exactly right.
Moving forward with especially the artificial intelligence, it's going to take great care, and it's worrisome, right?
Yeah, no, there's a great story I tell in the book about an algorithm that was intended to try to diversify hiring on gender in a STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. But it was trained on the existing data, which is it's mostly men that are in STEM. So it's predicting that the person to hire should be a man because a man has been historically the one who's been hired, completely counterproductive. And that's a simple example.
Yes.
but it's an illustrative one.
Well, if you've watched, you know, The Social Dilemma or...
Yes.
There's another one on HBO now called 15 Minutes of Shame. And it's about kind of individuals who, you know, again, but in that instance, they just do a really nice job of talking about how the algorithms work and what they elevate. But in Social Dilemma, just the conversations around the like button and some of the ramifications of the like button. Right? I mean, the unintended consequences of some of the decisions. It's amazing. I think of the butterfly effect, right? You know, we create a like button and all of a sudden it goes out into the world and oof, right? We don't understand how it can be weaponized or how it can be abused in certain instances. Randall, anything else that you want listeners to know before we close out? I have one more question after this, but I just want to make sure that I give you some time to say anything else that you'd like to about the book or about the work or where people can learn more.
Just want to break down that very last step, which is step 5, DEI impact. That's that letter I, once again, impact. And DEI impact says, now that I've established my strategies and my goals, and I go ahead and execute on those strategies, I then, in many ways, readminister the same assessment that started my journey. So if I was measuring inclusive behavior, measure it again. If I'm measuring inclusive culture, measure it again. And that, and then not only that, but see where you made progress and where you didn't.
Yep.
If for inclusive behavior, I made improvements on mitigating my biases, but I didn't make improvements on my level of curiosity about people who are different than me, then now the cycle goes right back to step one. You have another baseline because you've made improvements here and you have work to do here. And now you go back through all the steps again and again and again and again. And you're constantly learning. You're constantly learning more. And you're constantly growing through that journey.
The never-ending continuous cycle of data-driven.
That's right.
Right? I absolutely love it. I absolutely love it. So last question I always ask is, what have you been listening to, reading, streaming, watching? What's caught your attention in recent times? It could have to do with what we've just discussed, or it could have nothing to do with what we've just discussed. But what's been on your radar that's caught your attention that listeners might be interested in?
Well, to your point before, I made all of my children watch The Social Dilemma. The reason was twofold. A, I wanted them to be more savvy in how they use and navigated social media. But second to our overarching discussion here was I wanted them to see the echo chamber that they may be sitting in. And I'll give you a great example. On the evening of Donald Trump's indictment, I was watching CNN, MSNBC, and Fox in equal measure. And my son walked by the TV and he said, why are you watching all three of these programs? And I said to him, for the same reason why I asked you to watch The Social Dilemma, if I'm not seeing all the different points of view from the left, from the right, from the middle, then I'm not doing my job. I'm not able to navigate difference if I don't understand difference. And so I think that reinforced for him how to talk the talk, watch the movie. But then to walk the walk, like I'm literally watching all three programs, going in between each of them to see what they're saying, how they're analyzing it, and building my muscle for navigating and bridging differences across those communities of the like-minded that we discussed earlier.
I love you coming back to the bridging. I think that's incredible because that's walking the talk. And you're right. I do something similar. And oftentimes the narratives are polar opposites.
They're dramatically different. It's like you're in different worlds.
Yes, they are.
It's like you're in, and that's the point. That's the point, is that they are in many ways different worlds.
Yes, yes. It's fascinating to observe. But to your point, are you able to communicate and understand and at least work to empathize the different narratives and the differences so that you can be that bridge, right? I mean, it's...
That bridge. We need bridges now more than ever.
Yeah.
And it's Dr. King's words. We will not remember the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. if you are just well-intentioned, but in your own echo chamber, I got news for you. You're a part of the problem too.
We will end there. Sir, thank you so much for your time today. All of the information for listeners is going to be in the show notes is how you can access Randall's work, and you can access the book and all of the resource that he has put together. Dr. Pinkett, thank you so much. Can't thank you enough for being with us today. Thank you for your good work, sir.
Thank you, Scott. Appreciate you and your voice.
Okay. I enjoyed that conversation with Randall. Found it absolutely fascinating how he's thinking about this space of DEI. So we've got the inventory, we've got the imperatives, insights, initiatives, and then impact. Systematizing this work and really, really situating yourself in how you enter the space with that mission and that vision. And I loved hearing him describe how he's making sense of his mission and vision when it comes to DEI. Just a lot of fun. Very, very cool. Randall, thank you so much for your work. I'm excited to circle back and see how it's coming along, see what you're learning as this content interfaces with the world. That's going to be a really, really interesting conversation. And we will continue the conversation and continue the learning. Thank you so much, sir. And for those of you who are listening, I hope you are well. Take care. And as always, thank you so much for checking in.
You have just finished another episode of Practical Wisdom for Leaders with Scott Allen. To contact me, visit www.scottjallen.net or send me a note at scott@scottjallen.net. I can also be found on Twitter and LinkedIn, so let's connect. Now, if you have feedback, I'd love to hear it. And as always, thank you so much for listening. One final nod to our sponsors, the International Leadership Association and the Bowler College of Business at John Carroll University. And now, here's Kate's twin sister, Emily, with the outro.
You've been listening to Phronesis, Practical Wisdom with Scott Allen.